What would you do with $3.5 billion? Let me tell you, not a one human being said we would build more jails and prisons. And so we have to imagine what we would do with these dollars, with these budgets. And they have to really be an imagination that's grounded in care.
You also talk about the role of those who've been incarcerated, who've experienced the brutal impacts of prison and jail, being the leaders of the abolition movement. Can you talk more about that?
Sure. I think a lot about groups, you know, that I created, like Dignity and Power Now, who are really led by incarcerated people and their family members. Groups like Initiate Justice, who is doing statewide work here in California, really challenging sentencing here in California. And I think about work being done by prison feminists, Success Stories, an amazing program that was created inside California state prisons using bell hooks to challenge men inside prisons to be feminists. There is so much work being led by incarcerated people and their family members who have told us this system that we are inside of does not work for us. The words of Leonard keep, they're so resonant in me right now as he calls for human rights activists to do more. And part of that doing more is calling for abolition.
In An Abolitionist Handbook, 12 Steps to Changing Yourself and the World. Can you talk about the guiding questions? You end each of your 12 chapters with this series of tips and this set of guiding questions.
Yes. I thought about what I would have wanted as a young abolitionist. So much of the text when I was growing up was very academic. And while I enjoyed those texts, I really wanted more workbooks, more handbooks, you know, something where I can just like write in the margins and highlighter up and practice with my friends. And I don't take for granted that, you know, abolition is something that people are can be really scared of, that people can be really intimidated by. So I wanted to end each chapter with a set of questions that people could ask themselves, ask their loved ones, something that can happen around a dinner table, something that can happen in a Zoom room or a staff meeting. And I found a lot of joy posing those questions. They're questions that I go back to. I've been re-listening to the book, feeling really grateful for these principles because they're principles that I try to live by on a daily basis.
And finally, can you talk about the projects that you're working on now as you move on from the Black Lives Matter movement? Your project with Warner Brothers, working on a scripted project about cannabis, others that look at Black women leaders and the toll, you say, of living under a system that doesn't see us or makes us hyper-visible and also hyper-invisible at the same time.
Sure. I'm really interested in using the storytelling projects that I'm going to be working on to talk about Black women organizers in particular, Black women artists, and having us be protagonists in stories that we're usually not protagonists in. I'm also very interested in aestheticizing abolition. White supremacy and patriarchy has aestheticized itself. It's become a cultural project, not just a political project. So I want to do the same with abolition. I want to show people that abolition is not just a theory inside a book, but it's something that we can practice, and it's something that is culturally relevant for this time.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Patrice Cullors, on being with us and your new book, An Abolitionist Handbook, 12 Steps to Changing Yourself and the World. Patrice Cullors is the New York Times bestselling author of When They Call You a Terrorist. She's an author, educator, artist, and abolitionist, co-founder of Black Lives Matter, and a founder of Reform LA jails last year, stepping away from her role as executive director of the Black Lives Matter Global Network Foundation. And we will link to your writings and others as you move on. That does it for our show. We have a job opening. Human Resources Manager. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, and so many more. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. Remember, wearing a mask is an act of love.
RCT in sound from way out.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll look at some of the physiological dangers posed by new and old cellular technology.
We have with us today investigative journalist Barbara Coppell, who details her research about these critical and dangerous issues.
All around the world, every day, millions of people in communities suffer at the hands of ruthless government and corporate actors. We'll speak with scholar Maria Armudian about those people who live, as she says, quote, below the law.
She will also detail creative legal strategies to hold the human rights violators accountable.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
Most Americans are tethered to their cell phones and other devices that have built-in antennas to communicate with cell phone towers. And most don't give a second thought to whether these omnipresent devices are safe for human use. The telecom wireless industry touts cell phones as the greatest modern achievement, and it uniformly pledges the radiation they expose us to is safe. But scientists, on the other hand, caution that cell phones and their antennas expose humans and wildlife to a level of radiation that can result in brain and thyroid cancers and a host of other diseases. The advent of 5G, the fifth generation of mobile networks, will require more cell phone towers within smaller distances. Researchers and health experts worry that the public will be exposed to even higher levels of dangerous radiation. Powerful forces in the industry and in government have a stranglehold on how safety information is disseminated to the public. As sales soared worldwide in 2019, 1.52 billion smartphones were sold, the industry has even more incentive to ensure that scientific research is withheld. And last week, AT&T and Verizon finally agreed to delay expansion of 5G service near some airports. That was due to potentially catastrophic safety concerns repeatedly voiced by airlines and aviation regulators. Joining us today to talk about the health hazards of cellular devices and the industry's messaging is Barbara Coppell. Barbara is a Washington, D.C.-based investigative reporter who writes for The Nation, Washington Spectator, and other outlets about social, economic, political, and foreign policy issues.
We are lucky to have the investigative journalist Barbara Capel to tell us about the dangers of cell phones. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Barbara.
Well, thank you for having me.
Barbara, let's first get a sense about the scope of this problem. How large and powerful is the wireless telecommunications industry? And just to compare, how big are cell phone sales?
Well, about $500 billion just for the cell phones. And that's trillion, not billion. And that doesn't include the sales of the iPads for the tablets, which is throwing another, say, $20 billion a year, and laptops. All these devices that work off of radio frequencies that are very harmful. But the phones alone are $500 billion. And I wasn't able to find amounts for watches. People are walking around with watches now, holding them next to their bodies and using them in ways that have to be harmful.
How significant is the body of research and scientific studies that suggest cell phones and antennas that power them expose humans and wildlife to potentially dangerous electromagnetic fields?
Well, some scientists have been doing this since actually the 1980s in the EPA. The numbers vary depending on who you're citing, but anywhere from 500 to 1,000 studies or reviews of studies that are out there that show very harmful effects, especially the longer you use the devices, you have 4, 5, or 10 times greater risk of certain kinds of tumors and DNA breaks and other problems as well. But these studies have been going on for years, and it's just that the industry is so powerful with its helpers in different parts of agencies that are supposed to be watchdog agencies, which are not because they're staffed by people from the industry. They're so powerful that this information just doesn't get out there. If it gets out there, it's in journals, but it's not publicized because the newspapers and the media, all sorts of media, get a great deal of money from the industry in ads, and scientists get money from the industry to do their research. And as soon as they produce research that is not what the industry wants to hear, their money's cut. In one case, in fact, somebody from the industry called the president of the University of Washington and asking him to fire two of the researchers. He didn't, but, you know, to his credit. But they're ubiquitous, and they are extraordinarily. If you have that much money, and it's not just the industry by itself, but it's their partners in the press. For example, the paper of record, The Times, the single largest stockholder, or he was 2 years ago, is a guy by the name of Carlos Slim, who has 70% of the stock, 17. And he owns the largest wireless provider in Latin America. And he sits on their board. They're partnering with Verizon on 5G, as is AT&T partnering with Washington Post. So the newspapers rarely, and never in either of those two. I can cite a couple of examples that I turned up when I did a lot of research, but rarely publish anything that's detrimental. In fact, the Times heads will be something like 5G is safe, you know, don't let others confuse you, or Russia wants you to think it's unsafe, it's safe. I mean, ridiculous stuff. And I happen to know a reporter that was working on it at the Times and was taken off, and it was left just to this other science reporter because she wanted to include some other stuff.
Barbara, before we talk a bit about corporate messaging, just to clarify, you mentioned tablets. Aren't cordless phones or basically anything that has a built-in antenna that communicates with cell towers, therein lies the danger, correct?
Exactly, and I should have mentioned that. So that if, like, I have a landline phone that we're talking on now, and most of the scientists that I interviewed, and I interviewed about 50, use corded phones. And if they do take a cell phone with them, they don't put it anywhere near their bodies. You put it in a tote bag or something that's not next to you, because there have been enough studies to show that when you hold it next to you, you're going to get some damage of cells or cancers. You're absolutely right about the cordless phones that you have. Like, I've got this landline that's corded, but the piece that sits in my bedroom is not. So you have to be very careful that you use it on speakerphone and not next to your head. Closer you put it to your body, the worse it is.
Barbara, how does this risk compare to other industries such as tobacco and fossil fuel? Is the risk increasing?
The same way that they fought having the dangers exposed is exactly what this industry is doing. There's really no difference. And that's pointed out. The scientists who are very concerned about this often point that out, whether it's asbestos or what, whatever, that it's the same kind of pushback from the industry until they can't push back any longer. But that has certainly not happened, because this is like, as Richard Blumenthal, I think, was the one who called it the Wild West. Now, he said we're flying blind. The guy that was head of Microsoft Canada became a convert after he retired, and he says it's like the Wild West. He's a true believer in the science now. His name is Frank Clegg, and he said that there's just no... the information isn't out there, and it's very dangerous.
Barbara, in addition to suppressing scientific research, talk briefly, if you will, about the Cellular Telecommunications Industry Association. I guess that's the lobbying effort. How do they counter the narrative of wireless devices posing a public health risk?
They fund the scientists who will give them the answers they want. They take funds away from the scientists that produce results that show that the radiation is harmful. The watchdog agencies, which are the FCC and the FDA, they're supposed to be setting the rules, but they're run by people who have been in the industry. So Obama appointed Tom Wheeler to head it, and he had been the CEO of one of the largest trade associations. And then when Trump came in, he appointed somebody from a law firm that represented Verizon. So you stack the watchdog commissions with people who are from the industry. So the FCC to this day insists that it's 1996 rules about what's safe and what's not safe haven't needed to be changed.
Barbara, a $30 million decade-long study by the National Institutes of Health Toxicology Program, with results released in 2018, contradicted the industry's claims of safety. Why didn't we hear more about this?
For the reasons that I guess I didn't make too clear, but to hear more about it, the press would have had to have taken it up. But they have so much in advertising and the other links that they're partnering, so why would they tell the truth about that study? I don't think I actually saw it anywhere. And I read the Post in the Times. I mean, maybe it was in some other newspaper somewhere, but it just never got publicized. And that was because when it came out, the FDA said, nah, this is not important, because they didn't do it on humans. The tests were done on rats. However, the senior toxicologist on the study said that when they designed the study 10 years earlier, the FDA said, yeah, an animal study would be really good. But then it came out that the animals got cancers and DNA breaks. And so they said, no, this isn't relevant to humans. And then the FCC repeats what the FDA says. Well, the FDA says they're still safe, so they're safe. So you get this incestuous relationship in the watchdog agencies. And even in the CDC, the WHO, and NIH, at one time or another, had put something on their website saying, caution should be used. And then 2 months later, it was removed from the site. In the American Cancer Society site, the NIH site, definitely the WHO site, and the CDC site. Because somebody in industry looks at it and calls them and says, get it off of there. And they do. There's so much money. It's not billions we're talking about. We're talking about trillions. You know the power of that.
Barbara, speaking of the FDA, I understand they set safety limits for cell phone exposure back in 1996. Have they adjusted those since?
Never. The Environmental Health Trust, which is a citizen group, took the FCC to court to update their regulations. Interestingly, the D.C. Circuit Court ruled in their favor that they needed to look at recent studies since the 1996 regulations that they set. And the only thing was they didn't give them a timeline. It didn't say by 2022 you have to come up with new regs. You just have to review the studies that have been done, and they haven't. And they also, they were very specific. The court said that there has been shown to be effects on wildlife, on all sorts of effects on wildlife, not being able to mate, not losing their sense of direction, et cetera. And they haven't done any, there are no regulations on the environment. And again, when a city tries to fight it, the FCC passed rules and says we're the only ones that can pass these rules that say you may not stop us from installing cell phone towers, which you need many more of with 5G, many, you know, millions more, and I'm not exaggerating, but millions. And the FCC passed a ruling and so we said we're the only ones that can do this. You may not stop the companies from installing the towers. And if you don't give them a permit within 60 or 90 days, they can sue you for blocking them.
We are talking today with investigative journalist Barbara Coppell about the dangers of cell phones and 5G technology. Barbara, you write that, quote, the industry is spectacularly successful in ensuring that its message echoes far and wide. Its profoundly deep pockets purchase seats at all the right tables in the global and national watchdog agencies, media organizations, and scientific associations which manage the misinformation, unquote. How is this reflected in the funding of scientists and studies, and what happens to local jurisdictions that complain?
Well, the last part of your question, San Francisco and Berkeley tried. They wanted a law, they wanted to pass a rule that said that the companies had to, in their advertising, in the window, on top of whatever counters they have, they have to put what is a safe exposure and how closely or far away should you hold your phone from your head, because it's usually buried in my Samsung manual. It's on page 27, and it says how many centimeters. First of all, people don't know what centimeters in this country are. It's about a half an inch, and every millimeter that you do closer to your body, it's by, according to a scientist in Britain, it increases your exposure, he says, millions of times. So when they brought their suits, San Francisco lost because the industry just overwhelmed them, and they were afraid at some point and it was only because they wanted more information in the ads and where the phones were sold. Berkeley, they lost, and they didn't want to have to pay legal fees because they couldn't match, of course, the industry. The industry took its to counter San Francisco, which is supposed to have been having a conference. They moved it from San Francisco and put it in San Diego, so you're lucky you had them where you are. Berkeley brought a more limited law, and won, and then lost when the industry appealed it. They said that if you were asked, if they were being asked to make more information available, like how close can you hold it to your head, or that children shouldn't use it more than X number of hours, and they lost on the ground that this was a violation of their free speech and the First Amendment rights. A guy, a scientist, told me, I mean, it just works in every aspect it works. A scientist who was hired by a state, which he didn't want me to mention, to advise them on 5G, and he tried to tell them about the risks, and they absolutely were not interested. They only said, well, the risks are with phones that you get distracted when you drive, and so he had to shut up about it. New Hampshire set up a commission to find out information. I don't know that that's actually gone anywhere, but, you know, they had a couple of good people on the commission. But the industry just blocks these actions, and the groups that the WHO gets its information from are private groups in which the members, when you look at their conflict of interest forms, often they don't fill them out. And when they do fill them out, it shows that their labs get technology from the industry, that they're doing they're absolutely beholden to the industry. And so it's like a, you know, think of a spider and the tentacles, and just it's every single area, whether it's the watchdogs or the research that's done and then cut off, people getting money for buildings at universities and then that's cut off, it's ubiquitous. There's no area that they haven't been able to touch. I mean, imagine that this latest ruling where the district court in D.C. said you will have to look at recent studies to change your rules, but they didn't give them a time, which means it can go on for another 30 years.
Barbara, you probably read in the news earlier today that AT&T and Verizon finally agreed to delay expansion of 5G near some airports in the U.S. That was due to concerns about interference with onboard safety equipment. You've already mentioned the fact that there will have to be millions of more closely placed 5G cell towers. Are there other things we should be worried about? And because we're running out of time, this might be a good spot to give listeners tips on how to limit their harmful exposure.
Okay, and it's not just 5G, it's all the phones. It's not just if you happen to buy one, it's 5G. So the scientists that I've interviewed say there are some very, actually quite easy things you can do. One, if your Wi-Fi is getting very weak signals, those little bars on the top of your phone, your phone has to work harder and puts out more radiation to make your connection. You could be in a subway or a basement or somewhere in the countryside. Don't use your phone because it's putting out magnitude that's much higher of radiation. So that's one thing. Don't carry it next to your body. The Cleveland Clinic found that men who were carrying it in their pants pockets had reduced sperm and diminished fertility. Some women who run were carrying their phones in their bras, and the cup that they were carrying it in most often, that's where there was an increase in breast cancer. So don't carry it anywhere near your body. And use a corded phone at home whenever you can, which are becoming almost like dinosaurs. They're almost extinct. So when there are a few bars, don't use your phone. So those are the main things. And children, something like 50% of children under 12 now have phones. Children should not be using them or on a very limited basis, because there's enough research that's very strong that shows that long-term use, teenagers starting early, kids starting early, you have 4 and 5 times greater risk of developing certain cancers. So they certainly should be used very stringently by children, and just use it less. Don't stream. Streaming puts out a lot more radiation. If you want to watch a movie, download it. Don't stream it. the information's out there. You could look up the Environmental Health Trust, because they're the ones that brought that suit along with others, and they list many concerns. There's also a publication called Microwave News that's been following this for 20 years. So if you want to find out about it in depth, you can read that publication. It's very good.
Barbara, how do other nations compare with the U.S. in terms of how they're dealing with cell phone risks to the public?
Well, some of them are exactly the same, and others are quite different. Israel, let's see, France is one of the best, and it banned ads showing children using cell phones, and it banned wireless devices in daycare centers for children under three, and required Wi-Fi to be turned off in elementary schools when not in use. Israel banned Wi-Fi in kindergartens and banned ads showing children using it. Switzerland, Geneva placed a moratorium on 5G. Cyprus banned it in nursery schools and kindergartens, and also banned Wi-Fi close to a hospital. So some of them are doing a lot more than we are. And then many of them have the same problems that we do with extraordinarily powerful industry. Powerful equals trillions of dollars.
Barbara, how can listeners get involved in this issue and also read more of your work?
Well, this was published on December 2020 issue of the Washington Spectator. And it's long, but if you want to find out all the details, they're in there, and it's pretty accessible. I don't write it in a scientific manner. And I've just written a new piece on the FCC case, but that hasn't come out yet, the one that was won, but without teeth. And people want to get in touch with me, they can. My email, they can do it through the Washington Spectator, which published this piece, or my email. Do you want me to give you my email? Or
it's up to you. Sure, go ahead if you want.
Well, it's B for Barbara, and then Coppel, which is Koeppel, at comcast.net. Before you do that, it probably would be best to read the piece, the new one that will be coming out soon, because it will give you a lot of facts that will be readily understood. I promise that.
Barbara Coppel, thank you so much for sharing with our listeners this important information about cellular technology and how to stay safe. Thank you for being on Law and Disorder.
And thank you for having me.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. Over the years, Law and Disorder has interviewed dozens of people's lawyers bringing difficult social justice cases into the courtrooms, both nationally and abroad. These intrepid mavericks toil far from the limelight and often do so for little remuneration. Despite international conventions and human rights declarations designed to protect world citizens from illegal and degrading treatment, millions of people in communities suffer at the hands of ruthless government and corporate actors. Many have no remedy or recourse as they endure extreme and ongoing violence, including torture, slavery, or violent death. They exist outside of the law's protections, or, as scholar Maria Armudian puts it, below the law. How can these victims seek justice? Armudian has some answers to that question. In her new book, Lawyers Beyond Borders, Advancing International Human Rights Through Local Laws and Courts, she presents a 40-year examination of the movement, the cases, and their backstories. Her book reveals the struggles, impediments to justice, and the process of solving those problems.
It chronicles little-known stories about the field of what we call people's lawyering in politics, while sharing intimate accounts of how cause-related advocates craft creative strategies to bring injustices into the public arena. Her book also reveals how the process of litigation has value for so many in restoring a sense of agency to survivors of psychological trauma. Maria has written two other books, Reporting from the Danger Zone, Frontline Journalists, Their Jobs, and an Increasingly Perilous Future, along with Kill the Messenger, The Media's Role in the Fate of the World. She is a senior lecturer at the University of Auckland in New Zealand and produces and hosts the syndicated radio program The Scholars Circle. Maria served as an environmental commissioner for the city of Los Angeles for 5 years and served on the board of the taxi cab commissioners for 2. She also worked on environmental protection, government oversight, poverty reduction, civil rights, and corporate reform legislation for the California State Legislature. Maria, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much, Heidi. I am so thrilled to be with you.
Well, we are excited about your wonderful new book, Lawyers Beyond Borders. And I'd love to start by asking you, what inspired you to write it?
What a story. Well, I had been involved in politics for a very long time, you know, in the California legislature, as a commissioner in the city of LA, as a journalist, on all these nonprofit boards. And there was a question that was stumping me the whole time, which is, why is it so hard to make a difference? And I had been thwarted over and over and over with public interest legislation, usually by big corporations or other big interest groups that had sway with leadership or the committee or whoever it was when we were trying to pass legislation. And so I was quite despondent, and I went back to do my PhD to try to understand this very question, why is it so hard to make a difference? And at the same time, there was all this international human rights violation stuff that was going on in the world, and it just seemed so impossible to solve the problem. You know, I call these people who have become victims or survivors of torture or genocide or other egregious human rights violations essentially below the law, because they fall in between these jurisdictions often in which people can't help them. But then when I was doing my own radio program, The Scholar Circle, I had read about the case involving the villagers from Burma, now Myanmar, who brought a lawsuit against a giant oil corporation, Unocal, which is now merged with Chevron, and actually settled for about $30 million. And I thought, how did they do that? So that's where it started. And then that lawyer who was involved, the private lawyer, the boutique civil rights lawyer, Dan Stormer, who was involved and who I had interviewed, later told me that he was suing Ehud Barak for killing the flotilla, one of the flotilla volunteers who was taking aid to Gaza. And I thought, oh my God, really? Is somebody actually going to do something for these people? And I was so fascinated by the whole area that I wanted to find out more. And I was so inspired by that these lawyers would be so audacious and so creative to take these things on that I wanted to learn more. And that's why I did the book.
Well, you've piqued my interest because Dan Stormer is part of the boutique firm you describe is a California law firm of National Lawyers Guild members, and all of us on Law and Disorder are members of the guild. So we're excited to hear more about that. But let's start with a question. Just briefly, can you explain to our listeners some of the challenges in international human rights litigation? And then talk briefly about what universal jurisdiction is and why it's important to hold human rights violators accountable.
That's perfect. I mean, look, we live in a world of ideas that get enforced by militaries, right? So, you know, the countries are ideas, and international law is a set of ideas. And within that structure, you know, countries get a certain amount of sovereignty, meaning they get to do whatever they want in their borders to, you know, greater or lesser extent. And the law ends up protecting them, giving them immunity in certain cases and making it really difficult, unless they sign on to these international agreements, to prosecute them for these egregious human rights violations. And one of the problems is jurisdiction, right? Meaning sort of you have the legal authority to go after one of these cases. Again, these are ideas that somebody made up. Somebody made up the concept of jurisdiction and did it for obviously pragmatic reasons. It serves somebody. But there's another counter idea to that, which is a really beautiful idea. And that is that some crimes are so heinous and so damaging to humanity that they should be prosecutable anywhere and everywhere. And that is the idea of universal jurisdiction. Torturers fall into that, right? Genocidaires fall into that. These regimes that take on disappearing people, they fall into that. And so that's a concept that has enabled so many of these lawsuits in the United States and now abroad as well. And they're all sort of connected, which is part of what Lawyers Beyond Borders is showing, is how the movement got started in the United States with the ideas, one of them being universal jurisdiction, linked to a obscure statute that nobody had used for decades, and then the facts of the case. And it really inspired a movement to start that then sadly got crushed when the corporations started to get sued. But that didn't stop the movement all over the place. It just stifled it in the United States, but then it took off in Europe. Also sort of the brainchild in part of Peter Weiss, who started the movement to begin with, who started with Wolfgang Kalleck, the European Center for Civil and Human Rights, or I'm sorry, Constitutional and Human Rights. And they have been taking on the universal jurisdiction cases in Germany.
Yes, we know Wolfgang, and he's been on the show several times. So you've really put together not only a marvelous explanation for people who may not be aware of these lawyers and these cases, but for many of us, a compendium of some of our heroes in this field. I wonder if we might talk briefly about the Doe v. Unocal case.
I found these students so inspiring. They're no longer students, of course. You know, one's a law professor at Harvard, and one founded Earth Rights International. The third one has gone on to do other kinds of human rights and civil rights cases, Mark Bromley. Look, it's so inspiring. So as most people know, Burma has been, you know, under several military dictatorships over the years, has struggled with democracy. And all of these democracy advocates, including all the monks and the students, had been going out to the streets and protesting and calling for democracy, only to get arrested, detained, tortured, killed, and their movement essentially quashed. But the government then struck a deal, and this was part of globalization, the problems of globalization, struck a deal with Unocal to build the Adana pipeline. And instead of working with its citizens, it forced them by law, enslaved them on the pipeline, and worked them until they couldn't work anymore, and then often shot them dead because they were not useful anymore. Some of them, of course, were tortured, and others were like, wait a minute, I'm not doing this, and they fled. And one of the people who fled was Doe in the Doe v. Unocal lawsuit. But so what had happened was these three law students had gone to study the effects of globalization and met sort of, I don't know, I want to call it by serendipity, perhaps, is the best word. And that was Katie Redford, who was one of the co-founders of Earth Rights International. She met Kasawa, who she later married, and who worked with her in founding this. She and Tyler Giannini, the one who's at Harvard professor now, were asking themselves, is there a way that we can stop corporations from being involved, aiding and abetting, or even directly violating human rights of people? These are just the most egregious ones of all. Enslavement, for example, in these cases. And so she went back and made that her subject for her law school paper, her research paper, and started interviewing the human rights lawyers and civil rights lawyers over at CCR, to like Beth Stevens, to try to understand, could we use the Alien Tort Statute, which was the case or the statute that was used in the very first one for universal jurisdiction in the U.S., can we extend that to sue corporations and hold them accountable and make them stop these violations? And so this was the first case to actually try that. She always liked to try things that were just shy of impossible. And when she called CCR, Jenny Green said, well, you know, this is a big case. We're probably going to need help. And so they did go to Hadzell Stormer, in particular, Ann Richardson over there, who is now a judge, thought to herself, you know, there's so often we hear these awful cases, and most of the time we don't know what to do about it, and it just leaves us feeling terrible. But here's something we can actually do. And so she and Dan and the rest of Hadzell Stormer, along with Earth Rights and CCR, put together this team. They sued them first under federal law, using the Alien Tort Statute, with this idea of universal jurisdiction. When they got kicked out of federal law, while they were on appeal, they went to the state courts using common law. And so in these cases, rather than saying, oh, it's torture, you know, you go with battery, because that's common law illegal. You know, it could be an unfair business practice. You know, slavery is considered in some places an unfair business practice. And so eventually, the case settled for about $30 million, which actually does a lot for people who are living in a community like this, where things are not necessarily as expensive as they are in somewhere like the United States. And so they set up all these really great nonprofit entities to help their communities with that money.
I understand that just a week ago, a German court found guilty Anwar Ruslan, a Syrian colonel who tortured and killed really with impunity. So that's a victory. You discuss the case in your chapter on the globalization of justice. How does this case connect back, if it does, to U.S. attorneys?
Yeah, it connects back through the very wonderful Peter Weiss, who I think you've had on your program before.
Yes.
Now, Peter Weiss was the first person to try what they call a foreign cubed case. Foreign cube means you've got a foreign plaintiff, a foreign defendant, and the wrong occurred in a foreign land. Again, we're dealing with these laws around geography that are these ideas. You know, he used that Alien Tort Statute, which he doesn't remember how he found it, but it sounded like universal jurisdiction to him. And all it says in that statute, which, by the way, was passed by the first Congress as part of the Judiciary Act, but all it said was that aliens have access to the courts, or that the courts have jurisdiction over cases in which a tort, a wrong, has been committed that violates the law of nations. Well, sounded like torture, right? Mm-hmm. Sounds like genocide. And in the case that Peter used, which was 1979, the very first one that did this, a Paraguayan doctor named Joel Filartiga, which most people know the case by now in the legal community because it did create this movement, his son was tortured to death in Paraguay by a Paraguayan official. If you can imagine how awful that must be. And it was as punishment for the work that Joel was doing with poor people in in the country. So he and his daughter, Dolly, sued the man who tortured Juelito to death in the United States in U.S. courts and eventually won. That's what set everything up. That's what set up the Alien Tort Statute as a tool for universal jurisdiction. Now, when the War on Terror happened and the United States itself turned to torture, Peter Weiss wanted to sue Donald Rumsfeld and hold him accountable for the torture that the United States was committing. And because the courts in the U.S. were unwilling to take this up in a meaningful way, he looked around for other universal jurisdiction statutes, and he found the one in Germany being what he thought was the most powerful. Now, Wolfgang Kalleck, who has been a guest on your show, as you say, he and Peter together founded, along with a few other human rights lawyers, the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights. And they took up the case. So what happened in Syria is when it went into the civil war that it had gone into, and the regime was capturing anybody who dissented or protested and detaining them or killing them or bludgeoning them to death, one of the people in the intelligence unit was Anwar Aslan, who was doing this, who's just been, you know, found guilty of 27 counts. He had electrocuted people, bludgeoned them, stuffed them into vehicle tires. The trial started in April 2020, in part because all of these refugees had gone from Syria into Germany with eyewitness testimony. And then there was a photographer. I don't know if your listeners will remember this photographer's story. He used the name Cesar, which is a pseudonym. But he was an official photographer for the Syrian government, and he was supposed to be taking photos of whatever, accidents, and keeping them on file. But when these violations started to happen, he was photographing the bodies that were clearly just, you know, beyond recognition, damaged from the torture. He decided to go public with it, without revealing his identity. And he took the files, put them on a flash drive, stuck them in his shoe and his belt, smuggled them past several checkpoints, got them to a friend who then got it into the hands of Europeans. It was presented before Congress. It was presented in other institutions, the United Nations. Nothing happened in those institutions. But the family members of the victims started putting together the pieces. And that became part of the whole movement to get the accountability through the universal jurisdiction cases in Germany.
Do you have an opinion about how the German court might enforce punishment for this? Is there any precedent for us to guess what will happen to Anwar Aslan?
My understanding is that he's gotten a life sentence, or is getting a life sentence, in jail for this.
Okay.
And I haven't confirmed this yet, but that's what it looks like to date. It's a pretty horrific set of crimes that he's responsible for.
This is such really heartening news to hear about strategies being used to address cases of such severity and atrocities internationally, and brought by U.S. attorneys in many cases. As you know, there's been a shift in our legal landscape brought about in a large part by the Federalist Society's work over the last four or five decades, leaning very conservatively. And a lot of people in progressive communities are questioning not only the impartiality of our legal institutions, but also their validity. In light of this kind of success, do you have any thoughts on how more American attorneys and law firms might take heart from successes like these? And do you think there's any chance of our applying creative theories to address local issues or national issues?
I think national issues are really difficult right now, partly because of what you just described, sort of the, you know, takeover of the judicial system by ideologues, by people who are really far to the right, and who are whittling away at access to justice, really, for the most part, finding ways to keep people who have real claims out of the courts. And a lot of times, the people who are damaged are the ones who rarely have access to the courts anyway, don't have resources, and all of this falls onto the lawyers. I think there are a few things we need to think about in the long term. One is, when students go to law school, they end up with such enormous amounts of debt that they can't possibly do the kind of law that we're talking about right away, because they have to pay their law school debts back. And so they end up having to do other kinds of law, including corporate law. I think we have to find ways to prevent the caps on some of these judgments that really just comes out of the lawyers' fees. And it caps what lawyers are able to do, how much money that they can make on these other side cases that actually support the human rights types of cases. I think we need to find new structures that will enable people to pursue public interest law, human rights law, in terms of the financial end of it. Most of the lawyers in this book do the human rights cases on the side. So they are either full-time employees of nonprofit organizations, which need foundation money and other sources of funds to keep going, or they double as law professors, which means they can only focus on the human rights a few human rights cases, or they're pro bono at a big law firm and can only take on a few cases and have to be careful about conflicts of interest, which means that if there's a corporation there that using another lawyer, that they can't even take those cases on. So there are just all kinds of areas that we can work on creating the financial structures to support human rights litigation. But really, honestly, Heidi, I think we have a much bigger problem in the United States, and that is the ideological shift that has occurred. Gosh, I don't know. This is what my first book was about, Kill the Messenger. It's also a type of not understanding civic duty, how societies work, how policy gets made, and how policy works. And it's been replaced by kind of what I would call hate framing. That's what I called it in the first book, in which all politics gets essentially stuck into a soundbite, which is the left is destroying your country. And that has become such a powerful little meme. It's the same kind of thing they use, the same kind of framing they used in, you know, other wars and other genocides and other dismantling of democracies. And without having some better sophistication and understanding among people in the United States, it's really going to be difficult to shift the court's direction and the human rights direction.
I think that's right. And as you were speaking, I was recalling, I've been reading a bit up on the state of civics education in the United States. So in the 60s, we started introducing standardized testing into secondary schools. What used to be sort of a cocktail of several different kinds of civics classes that taught students not only how the government works, but also their rights and their opportunities to participate actively. As standardized testing became more and more the norm, those classes disappeared. We don't regularly make it a part of education, the rights and responsibilities that come with participating actively in a democratic representative form of government. And I think, as you say, things have devolved into such polarization that we can't even have a cogent conversation with one
that's
another.
Right. I think that's by design, by the way.
Of course.
And I also think that it's by design because of the profit and the money that comes with it. So even an entity like Fox News, for example, we know that it's just a circus, and we know that it's a source of hate framing. We know that that it's a big part of the demise. But if you look at what they do behind the scenes versus what they do on the television screens and internet, they're different. You know, News Corp was one of the greenest media corporations in the United States in the 2000s, way ahead. And yet, simultaneously, they were on the air calling scientists frauds, calling climate change a hoax. It was all for money. There's no other explanation. Why would they do one thing behind the scenes and say the complete opposite unless it was to rile people up, keep their attention, keep them angry and therefore addicted, and therefore, you know, make more money?
Maria, we'd like to take a moment, if you wouldn't mind, to talk about some of the content of your other books, which have focused on threats to journalists and also threats to the free press. Since all of this seems so related as we face increasing conflicts in our society, could you talk about the state of the free press in the U.S. as you see it right now?
Yeah, so the United States is one problem, and the rest of the world is also another problem. I know you're very familiar with all of the surveillance that is going on. You're an expert in surveillance. You know how that's going, both in the United States and abroad. It is one way to try to know everything, including things that should not be known, sources, for example, that journalists have.
Maria, we have so much more that we'd like to discuss with you. Clearly, you're going to have to come back to Law and Disorder. But we're running out of time. How can our listeners read your books and also listen to your wonderful podcast?
Well, the books are all available in the normal kinds of bookstores. Lawyers Beyond Borders, I would urge people to actually go to the University of Michigan Press website, partly because it's a nonprofit educational institution, and buying it directly from them, you actually get it quite a bit cheaper. Because it's an academic publisher, they do tend to run a little bit more expensive. But you can still download it on your Kindle or any other e-book that you have. Also, libraries are wonderful resources. If you can't afford to buy a lot of extra books, please check them out from the libraries. The podcast, The Scholar Circle, you could just find that at scholarcircle.org and click on any of the links. My other host, Doug Becker, is doing a wonderful job with that as well. Thank you so much for all of that.
Oh, Maria, it's been really a pleasure. Your work is so important, and you've, in this book, made a great contribution to the field. So I mean it when I say we'd like to have you back on again in a few months, and we wish you all the best in your efforts.
Thank you, Heidi, and thank you for all the work you do, not just with Law and Disorder, but your amazing books, especially on surveillance. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Maria, and it's great to meet a fellow Armenian.
Yes, exactly.
Have a wonderful day, and thanks.
You too.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Show DJ's in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
Yes, the decorum of the Biden presidency differs from that of the Trump presidency, but the underlying mercenary exploitation and sadism of American society remains untouched. We will extract ourselves from this culture of sadism, the way the dispossessed extracted themselves from the stranglehold of crony capitalism during the Great Depression, by organizing, protesting, and disrupting the system until the ruling elites are forced to grant a measure of social and economic justice.
That's Chris Hedges, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Chris Hedges, Questions and Answers on American Sadism, part two of a special two-part program. The great 20th century Irish poet William Butler Yeats wrote, "We had fed the heart on fantasies, the hearts grown brutal from the fair." The United States has long fed its heart with fairy tales about itself. Hardly a day goes by without some new story being spun about our noble intentions, benevolence, and devotion to international law. Sadism is not something new. Just ask indigenous peoples and blacks or the Vietnamese and Iraqis. Chris Hedges warns, the violence and exploitation which has long defined imperial projects now defines existence at home. For empires in the end cannibalize themselves. The tyranny we long imposed on others, we now impose on ourselves. The dark pleasure derived from exploiting others is all that is left. Our guest today is Chris Hedges. He's an award-winning journalist who has reported from the Balkans, the Middle East, and Central America. He writes a weekly column for Sheerpost.com, and he's the host of On Contact on RT TV. He's the author of many books, including Wages of Rebellion and America, The Farewell Tour. Chris Hedges spoke on the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on June 27th. The moderator, Megan Marone, asks the first question.
I guess a first question I have for you that I was just thinking about as I was listening is that to a certain extent, you know, all of the information that you include, all of the history that you include in the speech, and the contextualization of that, it's almost like you are a storyteller for the people who are open-minded enough to listen to you. In some ways, like if you're the type of person who reads and listens to Chris Hedges, then there's this openness, and in some ways you're framing history for us and contextualizing the current social and political moment. So I'm just wondering if you've ever seen yourself in that role, given that you include detailed historical accounts in all of your